Hello and welcome to another episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock and Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital money and helps you understand how digital money and assets evolve. I am co-host Michael Blaschke, and today we dive into the architecture of stablecoin issuers. Not just the blockchain technology, but the entire organizational blueprint of stablecoin issuers. That is, the business and operating models, the applications needed, the data needed, and the technology infrastructure needed to actually run a stablecoin business, and how these layers work together. While the market often primarily looks at market cap rankings and regulatory headlines, we're examining the foundational design choices that determine whether a stablecoin issuer can actually deliver on its promises. For this, I'm thrilled to have Thomas Cowan with us, head of tokenization at Galaxy Digital. Thomas brings a fascinating combination of perspectives to this conversation. He's worked at the epicenter of stablecoin innovation at Paxos, where he helped build PayPal stablecoin infrastructure. Before that, he was on the CBDC teams at both Ripple and the Boston Federal Reserve, giving him unique insight into both private and public sector approaches to digital money. His academic background is equally impressive: degrees in mechanical engineering and history from MIT, and both an MBA and Master of Public Policy from Harvard. This combination of engineering rigor, policy understanding, and business strategy makes him uniquely qualified to discuss the architecture of stablecoin issuers. Thomas, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Michael, and thanks for that intro, and looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, let's start by understanding why architecture matters in the stablecoin world right now. So stablecoins started as technical experiments, but they've by now evolved into financial enterprises or institutions already operating at global scale. Circle processes hundreds of billions in annual transaction volume. Tether holds reserves exceeding those of some central banks. And these aren't just tech projects anymore to me. They are really financial institutions with architecture challenges around business and operating model, applications, data, and technology infrastructure. Why do you think is now the moment when architecture becomes a differentiator between stablecoin issuers that thrive under institutional scrutiny and those that don't?
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of stepping back, if you look through the arc of all things tokenization and the different waves of adoption that we've seen across tokenization and crypto more broadly, we've seen stablecoins as having the example of the most product market fit in the space more broadly. And we see the three main use cases for stables as cross-border payments, overseas dollar access in emerging economies, and then as trading pairs for Bitcoin, Ethereum, and other digitally native assets. So given that there's clear demand and almost $300 billion in AUM for stables, the question is, okay, now that there's that demonstrated demand and interest, we're seeing an inbound and an influx of a lot of different types of stablecoin companies coming into the space across different jurisdictions and different parts of the market to really build out their own moats and come up with use cases for key clients. And so really, you know, this cycle, I think it comes down to three main points that are making this cycle different in that we have increased regulatory clarity from not only MiCA in the EU, the Genius Act in the US, and other regulations that have been passed globally. So we're getting regulatory clarity. The technology has become substantially more mature and more bulletproof than in previous cycles to meet or exceed, in some cases, the dependability and the resilience that you see with the SWIFTs, the Fedwires, the Visas of the world off-chain. And so between the regulatory clarity, the tech, and that final pillar, which is institutional demand and payment demand of finding a better, faster, cheaper way to move fiat, those three things have really demonstrated that there's demand here. And so these different companies come out and said, okay, we want to provide a stablecoin, a euro-denominated stablecoin, a dollar-denominated stablecoin, whatever it is all over the world. And the question is how they differentiate themselves. Because at the end of the day, you don't want to break the singleness of money. And so you know that you're going to want, you know, that dollar to be treated like a dollar or that euro like a euro. But the question is, how can these companies differentiate themselves to demonstrate that they are the on-chain euro you should choose or on-chain dollar you should choose? And that's why architecture is so key. Because stepping back, you're really just fighting for trust and ecosystem growth and network effects so that everyone chooses your stable over one of your competitors.
Yeah, so what I'm hearing there is that it's a confluence of three factors in the current cycle that demands stablecoin issuers to professionalize their architecture, their enterprise architecture. These three factors are, if I got it right, technology, regulation, and institutional demand, or the entry of institutions. So maybe we double-click on regulation. To what extent do you think is MiCA in Europe and potential US legislation such as the Genius Act are essentially forcing stablecoin issuers to further professionalize their architecture? So what happens to issuers whose architecture was defined for regulatory arbitrage like Tether, rather than this institutional resilience that you just alluded to, as in this cycle institutions enter the space?
Of course, that's kind of the central key difference in this cycle, is the fact that we're getting regulatory clarity. Because, you know, up until now, the past decade or so, crypto has really kind of served crypto use cases. We've been in this $3 or $4 trillion separated ecosystem, and a lot of the businesses have served that same ecosystem. Now that we're getting regulatory clarity, you know, people are looking to enter that space and grow the TAM substantially. And so now stablecoin issuers are going from, you know, serving people who are looking to buy Bitcoin to now serving major global organizations that we all know and rely on for our day-to-day economic needs. And in that way, it's just transforming the clients and the customers they're looking to serve. And so to do that, they need that trust, they need that regulatory clarity, and they need those partnerships to be able to make sure that they're the ones that the largest brands in the world are choosing to work with. And so really the difference is, and the reason for that major shift, is because to be able to work with the biggest names in different parts of the economy, they simply have to get the regulatory clarity and build that trust so that they're the ones who are selected to work with.
Yeah, I love to see I'm not alone in my quest for stablecoin issuers to further professionalize their architecture, at least those that seek to conduct business in a regulated environment. And I love to see that you agree with my perspective that in particular, the architecture lens can help here in accounting for the technology, for the regulation, for institutional demands. To me, a particular complexity of stablecoin issuers is what I refer to as the multi-stakeholder complexity. And Thomas, you've seen stablecoin business from every angle. You've been building infrastructure at Paxos, working with central banks on CBDCs. You're now advising from Galaxy's institutional perspective. A modern stablecoin issuer sits at the intersection of banking partners, blockchain networks, regulatory bodies, corporate customers, retail customers, auditors, capital markets. Each stakeholder has different requirements, different risk tolerances, different compliance needs. How does the architectural lens we adopt today, or architectural thinking, help navigate this complexity from your perspective?
Yeah, you nailed it with the number of stakeholders that you have to think through when you think about launching a stablecoin and think about the specific architecture that you want to select for a specific stablecoin. I think the number one takeaway that I've had, having been in the space for 6 years, 7 years at this point, folks just on putting, you know, currency on chain, is the simplest part is actually the crypto part. The smart contract, it just works. If you build it correctly, it just works and is the most dependable. The most complex part is the off-chain stuff, where you're right, you have to come up with a custodian, you have to work with a market maker, you have to work with, you know, all of the different banks that you have to make sure are custodying, you know, the fiat, repo, cash, whatever it is that you're backing your stablecoin with, and making sure that all of that integration with all those different counterparties all come together so that when your customer comes to mint or burn or interact with your stable, that they can in the most efficient and easiest way. And so much of it, when you're building it from the start, is making sure that you have that initial banking partner that can provide you those rails. You work with the key regulators to make sure that, you know, an on-chain dollar and an off-chain dollar can be treated exactly the same, and that you have the distribution partners from a market maker perspective, as well as the key exchanges, so that when people go and want to buy your stable, they know where they can and how they can, and it's an easy and efficient experience. So it very much is balancing probably a dozen different stakeholders across all different parts of not only regulatory stack and tech stack, but also the financial stack. And I think the financial side is the most interesting one to me, at least, because it's all new to a lot of TradFi. And so you end up, one of the biggest challenges you end up having is just the educational curve, saying this is really just better, faster, cheaper. We're not, you know, upending the fiat denominated system. We're just upgrading the fiat denominated system to make it all move a little bit faster.
Yeah, and in this multi-stakeholder setup or even complexity, traditional financial institutions or TradFi players are involved, like the banking partners or like in corporate customers that use stablecoins themselves. Are there architectural patterns from these financial institutions that are applicable to stablecoin issuers versus patterns that need to be completely reimagined? So in building a stablecoin issuer, what can we basically copy from TradFi players and what needs to be completely reimagined?
Yeah, that's a fun one. I think you can take that in a lot of different directions. I mean, in some ways, a stablecoin is really just a money market fund with a wrapper that doesn't pay through its underlying yield that then moves around on chain, right? Like on the back end, that truly is what it is. It's an SPV filled with, you know, cash, repo, and treasuries a lot of the time in the US. It's that simple. When you think of it from a financial view, it's okay, this is, you know, these funds exist. It's an asset manager on chain. The other side is from a tech perspective, is it's this token that can be moved around, you know, very, very quickly and used in all kinds of different use cases, you know, not just to pay salaries in emerging economies or maintain or grow wealth in non-dollar denominated societies, but also for, you know, looping and you know, all kinds of DeFi use cases in crypto more broadly. So there are so many different use cases here. And the question is what we can use and what we can learn from TradFi is applicable to then use in crypto. And I think the number one thing, this is, you know, maybe not tangible, but the number one thing that a lot of the stablecoin builders should think through is they need to take trust as the number one thing from TradFi, because that is really what TradFi does well and what they've perfected in you know, hundreds of years that banks have existed, is they're good at having people trust them. And that's something that crypto really needs to improve on, given our previous cycles and the highs and lows of the industry. The more trust you can build as a brand on chain, as a stablecoin, the higher AUM you're going to be able to get and the better network effects you're going to be able to get, because people will know that, you know, that token on chain is fully backed and is fully redeemable, and other people feel the same way. And then you build the flywheel.
It's interesting you're saying this, because I mean, actually, the crypto community set out under the principle, don't trust, verify. And what you're saying now is that stablecoin issuers ought to copy the level of trust that financial institutions were able to build with their corporate and retail customers. So where in operating a stablecoin, where in the architecture is the trust needed? Is it on the operating model level where you have the minting and burning processes? Is it on the architectural layer that the IT infrastructure is uncompromisable? Where exactly in the layers of a stablecoin issuer is trust at least most important?
Yeah. So, I mean, you can think about it as concentric circles. So the biggest one, of course, is just that you have a trusted brand, right? And then when you go to an exchange or a first buyer, wherever you're going to buy your money, your stablecoin, you want to make sure that that tech experience and that onboarding experience is seamless. And then you get to the core of, okay, well, what is this? What is actually backing this stable? You know, where are the reserves? How liquid are they? Who's the PM actually making sure that, you know, a dollar is backed by a dollar on chain and off chain? And so that key backing is something that of course is paramount given previous cycles, and the Terra Luna is a good example that people often bring up. Granted, that obviously was not fiat backed, and then we can go down that rabbit hole as well. But from a fiat perspective, it is making sure that you are posting the QSIP of the different assets that are backing the stable at a given interval, so that people know that they can go and they can see the back end, the full backing at all times. And that's kind of the cornerstone, so that I can know, okay, I'm holding this stable. It's backed by US government debt, which is, you know, the risk-free rate.
Excellent. So with that, let's move away from our like motivational or introductory conversation on why and why now the architecture lens is effective for bringing stablecoin issuers one step further in this cycle. And let's move on to the core of our conversation, that is the actual architecture of stablecoin issuer. So I'd like to walk through the enterprise architecture of a stablecoin issuer using a four-layer framework that helps us understand how these issuers are actually built. At the top, we have the business and operating model layers. This is about strategy, business processes, and how the organization, so the stablecoin issuer actually operates day to day. Then second, below that sits the application layer, the software systems and platforms that enable those operations. Third, then we have the data layer, how information flows through the organization, how it's stored, reconciled, reported, what data is actually needed. And then at the foundation, there's the technology infrastructure layer, the blockchain network, security systems, hosting environments, and integration points that everything else sits on top of. What to me makes this framework powerful is that it shows how the decisions cascade. So your business model choices on the first level constrain your application architecture, which determines your data requirements, which shapes your infrastructure needs. So let's now walk through each layer and explore how they fit together in a well-designed stablecoin issuer. Let's start at the top with the business and operating model layers. We've seen fundamentally different approaches emerge in the market so far. Circle positioned as financial infrastructures, Paxos, where you work, built a regulated exchange and infrastructure platform. Tether operates more like a shadow bank, in my interpretation. Now, banks are exploring tokenized deposits as yet another alternative paradigm entirely. How do these different business model choices cascade through the entire architecture once the choice is made? Can you there probably give us an intuition or an example of how the architecture depends on this business and operating model layer?
Yeah, happy to dive in. Before I kind of break down the Paxos versus the Circles versus the Tethers, one thing I'll note is in TradFi, the singleness of money is very much a given. And people look at a dollar always being a dollar, when in reality, a dollar in my, you know, PayPal account versus my JP Morgan account versus in a money market fund versus all these different things that you think of as a dollar is kind of abstracted away, and I just think of it as a dollar. In reality, those risk profiles of those dollars held by different institutions are very different. And so with stablecoins, we're in this early phase where we're still thinking through, well, is one USDC equal to one Tether equal to, you know, all these different types of stablecoins. And we're still early, and long term, when kind of the dust settles, we'll be back to having, you know, a dollar being a dollar. It just happens that on the back end, they might settle on different networks or be liabilities of different institutions, but it'll still be a dollar. But today, we're kind of in that middle phase where people really have to think about the architecture, because the architecture matters a lot as the industry matures. So to that end, if I were to think about the different business models that are kind of emerging, I'd kind of put it into three main buckets. The Paxoses of the world, they very much look at stablecoin offerings as turnkey solutions. So they can do white label. So someone can come to you and say, hey, you can pick any major institution. They want a stablecoin. They can go to Paxos, and Paxos can offer them a full turnkey solution where it's, you just rebrand it, but the back end is identical. And that's super beneficial and is a very quick way to market, because the code's already there, the banking network's already there, the PM is already there. All of that back end is already just done. So that's a very easy way to get there. So that's bucket one, is the white label model, which is super interesting. I think the challenge there is if you follow that to the extreme and everyone were to do that, you'd end up with a Walmart coin, an Amazon coin, a Facebook coin. You'd go down the list and all of a sudden you'd be like, oh my God, why in my wallet do I have two dozen different types of dollars that are all liabilities of these different companies, right? So that's one extreme to think through. I think they'll all consolidate in the long run, but short term, that's definitely something to think through for the white label solution. Then I think there's the other bucket too, when I think of Circle and other major stable coins, is they very much think of themselves as a payment rail, increasingly, at least in my personal view, in that it's a more efficient way to move fiat currency between different players so that you don't have to depend on the correspondent banking network system. You can just move dollars peer-to-peer instantly for, you know, fractions of a cent. And that is just a new payment rail. I think the challenge there, while it's key, and I think it will drastically increase the number of payments globally, it changes the business model of stablecoins that people know of as today. Because stablecoin business models today are have people buy these things, hold them, don't pass the yield to them, and then you just get 4% on the underlying. That's the way they are today. But if they just become means of payment and not a store of value, that is the biggest challenge there, because then people use your product just for a fraction of a second if I pay from Thomas to Michael, and then they'll flip it into something that pays them the yield. And then they're going to have to shift their business model to be more like a payments firm instead of an asset management firm. So that's that second bucket of how I would approach it.
If you don't mind, so I would assume that all Unity, which is kind of your latest project that you accompany or contribute to, would fall in this second bucket too, right?
Yes, it would. And I think it's a good example of many stablecoins in the space that are similar to Circle recognize that their initial use case, their beachhead use case, might be payments. But that means that, like many other companies, they'll end up broadening out their offerings to be able to, you know, offer many different products to their users. I mean, similar to Google is a perfect example, right? They started with just the search engine, and then they offered so many different additional products once they had people on their platform. And I bet that that's what we'll see this second bucket focus on, is once they have people using them as a means of payment, then you can begin to offer many other additional services that allow you to monetize that relationship that you have. So I think that there's a lot of different room to get creative with that, and we'll definitely see the major players come in and think through different ways to monetize the relationships that they're building. That third bucket I think of course, is Tether. I think of a Tether long-term as kind of the on-chain Eurodollar market. And what I mean by that is I think there'll almost always be a demand for overseas dollar access in emerging economies, in places where regulations might be a little bit lower and where people might be much more willing to, you know, go above and beyond to get dollar access to be able to maintain it and grow their wealth outside of their local currency. And so I think that business model will continue to grow, but I don't think it will integrate across the entire economy, simply because in a lot of the major countries today, from a regulatory perspective, they'll likely focus more on the first two buckets where there's a little bit more trust and clarity.
So now, understanding your three buckets, if we push this one step further, would you be fine with the following labels for these archetypes or buckets of stablecoin issuers? So number one, the Paxos model would then be turnkey or white label provider that is like an infrastructure platform, right? The Circle bucket, if you will, is a financial infrastructure that seeks to bypass the traditional payment rails of the banking system. And then most controversial probably is the Tether, the third bucket that I referred to as shadow bank. So are you happy with my labels of infrastructure platform, payment railways, and shadow bank?
What I will say on two and three is, on two, I don't see it as replacing the existing system. I see it as another avenue through which to move value that is augments it and allows for additional payment flows. And a good example is, I could still write a check and mail a check to you. The system still works, but I likely won't. But that is still an option, right? I could also still wire you money, but, you know, I can now use Venmo and many other use and Zelle and many other use cases. And I look at stablecoins and bank deposit tokens and retail CBDCs, if we get down that route, as additional ways through to move value, but I don't see it as supplanting all these other options. So that's the second bucket. The third, I think that you know, we're still early in what the end use case will be for what overseas dollar access looks like at scale. A lot of that is dependent, I think, on two things that we need to really see. First is regulatory clarity in, you know, many other countries, emerging economies specifically. And second would be how the technology is actually accessed and whether governments are going to be able to figure out a way to protect and maintain monetary sovereignty of their local currency or whether dollarization could expand because stables are so much more widely available, not through the intermediated system that we exist today using commercial banks. So I think that third bucket, we still have a few, the jury's still out. That's kind of how I would approach it.
Yeah, it's cool. We distilled and characterized these archetypes of stablecoin issuers so well because it makes it easy to imagine or to develop an intuition that once this business decision is made in which of these three buckets you play, how this business model choice cascades down through your architecture. So the architecture of a Tether most likely looks pretty different to one of Circle.
Yeah. Yep.
And when we now move one step ahead and look at the actual operating model, so the actual processes for reserve management, minting and redemption, compliance monitoring, customer onboarding. How, in your experience, do you design these operational workflows that satisfy institutional compliance requirements while still maintaining the speed and programmability that makes stablecoins valuable?
So that's the balance that's kind of the fun part of this whole industry, right? In many ways, this is ground zero of the intersection of payments and TradFi and crypto, right? Because you need to make sure that you're able to marry those two worlds. And from a functional and organizational perspective, this is where you see it in practice. And I think one thing that is key here is to make sure that you hire the people who understand TradFi and understand how to actually, manage a portfolio of assets, as well as people who understand what these stablecoins will actually be used for, how minting and burning is actually done, and what that interaction looks like, so that then you can build a software package that marries both. And this, I think, is the biggest differentiator of the internal workings of a stablecoin, is the companies that are able to marry those two worlds and demonstrate that they have the trust and experience of managing and moving money off-chain, as well as the additional technology and advancements in smart contract and kind of design to be able to match the on-chain use case. That is kind of the blend that you need. And frankly, as someone who's very much building here at Galaxy, that skill set is unique and hard to find. And I'm excited to continue to see more and more people enter this space, whether that be from crypto or from TradFi, to be able to learn both worlds, because we very much need more people to be at that intersection.
So at the stablecoin issues that you contributed to and are still contributing to, can you give us any intuition how designing these operational workflows looks like? So is it that you just start somewhere and then they grow after go live from day one? Or was it really greenfield workflow design X month before go live and very specifically formulating and documenting these workflows before you can actually go live?
It's definitely a lot of whiteboarding and formulating all of the workflows before you go live, and a lot of edge cases, and making sure that everyone is speaking, the same language, to make sure that you think of an edge case that's in crypto, because that'll ricochet down to TradFi, and an edge case that is in TradFi that'll also ricochet to crypto. A good example is, the settlement times for treasuries and how you're actually able to manage the underlying treasury and how it can match to the best of your ability the minting and burn operations that you'll want to be able to offer 24/7. In the US, one of the biggest challenges that the stablecoin issuers still have today is making sure that if someone, mints or burns on a weekend, that the underlying treasury still is able to match one for one. And as you can guess, because the banking system is still only on during the weekdays, it means that there is some asset liability mismatch there that everyone has to kind of manage. So that's definitely something that we have to think through and solve for when you look to build this out. One thing I will say is the idea of truly whiteboarding and thinking through all these edge cases, it feels a little bit like you're taking puzzle pieces and you know what the end goal is, but none of the puzzle pieces initially fit together. It's 100 pieces and you really have to think through, okay, well, we can get this and this from this player and this from that player. And you put them together and you realize they don't quite fit. And then you have to build out a new software package. It's one of those things where it takes a long time to get all the different parties together. But then once you do, you can test the end-to-end architecture flow to make sure that it is as seamless as possible. And then you're finally ready to to go live. And at that point, you have to make sure that you've thought through the regulatory side and the go-to-market side so that you have a full cohesive product that then you can enable for use.
And then I can well imagine then even after go live, still this operating model, so this set of processes evolves, yeah, and you quickly learn. I mean, this is the first time in history that stablecoin issuers emerges as a new type of enterprise or of institution that potentially then grow or evolve into enterprise level organizations. Is business and operating model layer we so far talked about, in my naive assumption, that is the layer in which you contribute to the stablecoin issuers. I might be totally wrong there. Maybe you focus more on the applications, more on the data, more on the tech infrastructure. But am I right in assuming that, for example, at the moment at AllUnity or back then at Paxos, this was the layer you as head of tokenization contribute to?
Yeah, so at Paxos, I was involved on the strategy side, thinking through go to market, thinking through how, you know, we could help the different providers we worked with make sure that the products were as well positioned in the market as possible. At Galaxy, I wear many hats, but for AllUnity, I'm on the board there and very much worked with Alex and the team to think through different ways of how we build a euro denominated stablecoin. And as an American, you know, looking at the euro market, we saw a huge opportunity from the Galaxy perspective that there really hasn't been a major euro denominated stablecoin yet that has really dominated the market at scale and helped build out the market in a way that we think will be in the long term. And so from an AllUnity perspective, that's really the interest and how Galaxy approached the space. And, you know, at this point now it's very much supporting AllUnity as it continues to grow, and we're excited by what's ahead.
This is a cool time in our interview as we now can really double click on your perspective on Europe. I mean, you've spent the major part or the whole part of your career in the United States, I would assume, and the businesses you contributed to have the headquarters in the United States. On the other hand, you now co-invested and co-contribute to AllUnity, a European denominated stablecoin. And with that, I think you observe a lot of what is going on in Europe, such as MiCA regulations, such as the intricacies of launching a stablecoin business in Europe. So yeah, can you maybe shed some light on the on observations you made, even observations that were amusing or nerving?
Yeah, I guess one thing that's fascinating is I've been in the space long enough that when MiCA finally crossed the finish and it seemed like there was clear regulatory clarity in Europe, we Americans kind of looked across the Atlantic and said, okay, is the crypto market going to absolutely explode in Europe? Is the center of all things crypto going to shift? And I think what it showed is, while it showed promise and importance and a very key step in the long journey that we all have of moving the financial system and the payment system on chain, it's very important to think through where the talent is, where the innovation is, and how you have to pair that with regulatory clarity to make sure that, you know, the next major companies that are founded and make this transition are in places where there is regulatory clarity. And so now that in the US we got the Genius Act through and now we're seeing the implications of it in the longer term as people begin to build out compliant products in the next 18 months or so, we're really going to see what that looks like. But one thing that I've been, you know, as an American, pleasantly impressed by and surprised by, frankly, is how much capital has flown into the space, how much talent has flown into the space, and how much interest has flown into the space over such a short period of time, specifically in 2025. And it means that I meant actually in the US in terms of in 25. When it comes to Europe, it's clear when I do travel there and go to Frankfurt and Ireland and other places and London, it's clear that there's a lot of interest and innovation that's happening. I think the question is how the European market can work to grow and have, you know, for stablecoins specifically, and really find that product market fit for why when someone goes on chain and they're looking for, you know, their fiat on chain, that they would go and have a euro versus a dollar, right? Like that decision, still that FX decision is still something that I think the market needs to decide and really build out a key use case for. I think that will absolutely happen, no question. But I have been surprised kind of across the board of how quickly this market on both sides of the Atlantic has moved and will continue to in the longer run.
Excellent. Yeah, with that, let's close the bracket on both US and EU differences, but also let's close the bracket on this business layer we now spend some time on and move one layer down in our architecture model that is now the applications a stablecoin issuer needs to effectively and efficiently run a stablecoin business. So I would assume that a sophisticated stablecoin issuer needs multiple applications that work in concert. And then from all your experience, or especially from your Paxos experience building PayPal stablecoin, how do you architect this application layer to bridge traditional financial systems and blockchain operations? So can you list some applications that a stablecoin issuer needs? Potentially, a stablecoin issuer needs a ERP software to run traditional business processes like order to pay in case you need to order something in a market. Yeah, so what are the applications that you need to buy a license or that you need to develop yourself to really run a stablecoin business?
Of course. So I will refrain from, you know, going through a laundry list of the actual applications that these different institutions use. But I think what's important is you can bucket it into a few approaches. One is just the actual crypto-focused tech stack, right? That actually is going to manage the smart contract itself, just the mint burn function as well. So that's the first one, and kind of, I would say, one of the most obvious, that, you know, you can work with a tokenization agent or stablecoin agent to do that turnkey tech software package that you're going to need. That is relatively standardized at this point. That is probably the one that's most obvious. The next one I would really highlight is from a regulatory perspective, because trust is so key and regulation is so important here. You really need to make sure that you have different software packages that allow you to make sure that you're, you know, the blacklist that you're managing when you get flags that need to kind of freeze or seize different wallet addresses, that you can do that. And so having a software package that allows you to manage that and respond quickly and identify those risks on chain is paramount. And so there are a few different options in the market, and this is quite impressive, especially how much progress has been made with these even in the past 5 years. So that's one thing to think through. The third that I would really think about is all things off-chain. To your point, ERPs, the normal systems you would need to run any kind of company, you're going to need in this instance completely off-chain. One thing that we would really think about would be how you're going to manage your treasury, how you're going to make sure that you actually are custodying and moving around all these traditional financial instruments that are backing your stablecoin. And one thing that's important is you're going to end up with, of course, multiple bank accounts, and some will be 24/7, some won't be. And so just making sure that from a liability management perspective, that you're positioning all of your cash in the right place so it's as liquid and available as possible while still matching the return profile that you're looking for on the internal side is very key. And so you have a lot of different software providers that enable that. The last one that I'll double down on really is risk management, and that's both off-chain and on-chain. There are a few names on-chain that come to mind that not only look at kind of the you know, blacklist monitoring that I mentioned earlier, but also blockchain monitoring and application monitoring and exchange and market making monitoring, just to make sure that where your stablecoin is, it's being used in the best ways, and that your different partners are also still matching risk frameworks that you're fine with as an issuer. So that's everything on chain. And you have to do the same thing off chain as well, to think through what are the risk profiles here? What are the edge cases to be aware of and to problem solve for, so that when an SVB event happens, for example, you kind of already know and have a full playbook to make sure that your stable is still fully backed 24/7 and that you have the liquidity to be able to provide to your users. That's just a handful of different ways to approach the different software packages. The takeaway is, sounds simple, just to, you know, spin up a company that accepts dollars off chain and shoots you a token to your wallet on chain. And it's, you know, pretty complex when you get into the weeds.
Yes, indeed. So when I tried to write down all the applications needed, I also thought about the actual systems that let you interact with the blockchain to manage smart contracts and transaction broadcasting, then banking integration platforms that handle fiat movements, compliance and monitoring applications for the screening of transactions and sanctions checks. Then there are customer-facing applications for minting and redemption requests. You have treasury management systems for reserve operations and the reporting infrastructure for the regulatory filing. So while it is actually a super simple value proposition, as you described, that money market fund that is wrapped into a token requires such a sophisticated set of applications. And this is only the set of applications needed. And for each of them, the stablecoin issuer also then has to decide whether to buy, whether to make, or whether to reuse the application. So let's take AllUnity. Yeah? AllUnity could buy any of these applications. It could develop it itself, which I think in today's dominant view of architecture is chosen barely or not at all. But for stablecoin issuers, it might be true that some of these applications need to be individually developed as this business model is so young. Or the third option for any of these applications is just reuse it from one of the three investors, like reuse it from DWS, mm-hmm. from Galaxy. So can you confirm that this is an intricate choice for all these applications to decide, make, reuse, buy, or was that a straightforward decision at AllUnity?
Yeah, so it depends on, you know, different companies, of course, are positioning their products in different ways and make different business decisions based on who they're going for and what they value. For AllUnity specifically, we really did. That's one of the key benefits of the company itself is that because the three backers are Galaxy, DWS, and Flow Traders, it means that for the backend fiat management, you can use DWS, which is, you know, one of the most well-known asset managers in the world. Galaxy for the tokenization and market making, which Galaxy is known for just because we've been in the crypto space for a long time. And then also the market making and distribution of Flow Traders as well. So it means that you can take these three companies that have leadership roles in three different parts of the industry and put them together in a way that really positions AllUnity to be able to leverage all three in a way to advance the company and position it well in the market more broadly.
Excellent. And with that, we touched upon the second layer. And now I move on to the third, that is data. So let's talk about the data layer, which I think is one of the most underappreciated aspects of stablecoin businesses, although it's so interesting with the emergence of generative AI and AI in general. Maybe we are already too deep in the architectural stack of stablecoin issuers, but have you been involved in conversations around the proper data model for a stablecoin issuer that needs to maintain perfect synchronization between on-chain token supply, off-chain banking ledgers, and then reserve asset positions? Is there a need to develop such a data model, and were you involved in such conversations?
So this actually is one of the most interesting parts for me of the market more broadly, because I think a lot of obviously the vast majority of the global economy is still very much TradFi. And then in our little niche in all things crypto, we're like, oh, well, everything's going to be on chain. Well, in reality, for, you know, at least the next decade, likely the next two, we're going to be at the intersection of both worlds. And so we're going to need data providers and different companies and servicers and vendors that are not only happy and can operate at both worlds, but can represent both worlds on chain to other companies that are at that intersection. And Galaxy is actually a perfect example because we have the DNA of TradFi and the expertise of crypto. It means that very often we work with a lot of partners like this that are comfortable in both worlds to be able to pull data to make sure that from a risk perspective and from a, you know, treasury management perspective and you know, all, and the like, all of that comes together to make sure that we have the best picture of what's happening both on and off chain at all times. And that is obviously a tall order. And it's also fascinating when one side of that, the crypto side, there can be something interesting happening, or on the TradFi side, right? Like on a weekend, for example, a lot of that focus is on all things crypto because the markets are closed in traditional finance. And then quite often, you know, over the past few months, there's been a lot of action in you know, traditional finance. And so making sure that we understand and can price in all the different actions that are happening could impact, different parts of the business is important. So to me, what I'm fascinated by is the fact that there's going to be a lot of companies that are founded and all they do is just provide and analyze data in both worlds and bring them together for companies like AllUnity, Galaxy, and others to be able to ingest them and make decisions based on that data they provide.
Yeah. To me, one of the foremost data challenges is the reconciliation challenge or even issue specifically. So in traditional finance, reconciliation happens at the end of day or even T plus one. With stable coins operating 24/7 across multiple blockchains, how do you then architect a continuous reconciliation process that can detect discrepancies in real time and trigger appropriate responses to reconcile these two worlds?
And that's the fun part too, is that we're still so early in this. We're still in the second inning of all things stablecoins, that there's no one industry solution where it's like, oh yeah, just provide this and you're done. You know, it's not as if a financial firm, there's no Bloomberg equivalent where it's like, yes, this is where you're going to get the vast majority of your data to make your investment decisions. We have not quite got there yet with all things crypto. And so there's a lot of green space, and it means that different stablecoin issuers have a few different options and need to really do their diligence and think through the cost and benefit analysis of that, because there isn't one market leader that everyone is using that's standard.
Excellent. So finally, to conclude our walkthrough for the four layers of a stablecoin issuer's architecture, let's now examine the technology infrastructure. This includes the blockchain infrastructure itself, cloud or on-premise hosting of any of these applications we talked about before, the security architecture of the stablecoin issuer, which also heavily contributes to the trust needed, then disaster recovery systems and the integration points with banking partners and payment networks. To narrow it down, from your perspective, what are the critical technology infrastructure decisions that really determine whether a stablecoin issuer can scale to institutional volumes while maintaining operational resilience? So I'm looking here for the critical decisions on this infrastructure level that determine then really if a stablecoin issuer can scale.
Yeah, I mean, the easiest two would be the tokenization agent and the custodian, the initial custodians that you work with, because those are the two things that make a stablecoin company different compared to other companies, right? Like, to answer that question, there are a bunch of other products and services that you're going to have to think through. But from a stablecoin perspective, those two are really ground zero when you think of, okay, where do you focus? And finding, you know, an initial set of custodians that you trust and work with are key, as well as making sure that the tech stack that you're using for the smart contract initial build out as well as maintenance is also key, just to make sure that you have that trust and that flexibility when you decide which chains to go on at what point, when you expand, how you analyze the risk profile as well as the build out for those chains and what that looks like more broadly. So I know we're running low on time, but to me, those are the two buckets I would focus on would be, you know, the custodian and then the actual tokenization agent.
Okay, and let's maybe double click on the tokenization engine. What's the intricacy here? Why would it be, if this decision were made suboptimal, how would it hamper the scaling of a stablecoin issuer? So if done imperfect, what would be the issue?
Yeah, the biggest thing I'd focus on is experience. And when you work with a company that has a lot of experience with launching, you know, smart contracts, whether it be stablecoin, money market funds, whatever it is, the biggest thing you'll notice is not only will you know that the smart contract is just going to be, you know, more resilient and you can upgrade it in a much faster rate, but you also just know that from a trust perspective that it'll be there. So it's not rocket science in terms of where we are today. I think in terms of complexity, it's some of the simplest smart contracts that we have, but it's very, very important to make sure that you work with someone who has that experience to design it in the best way possible, and that it can be designed so that you not only can integrate across different custodians, wallet providers, and the like, but also allows you to monitor and have freeze and seize capabilities that you really do need for stablecoins to be able to build the trust and the network effect that you need, so that if you know it falls into a wallet that has been flagged, you know how to execute, you know how to move forward and act and action when you see that happen.
All right, so tokenization engine and the actual custodian are then, from your perspective, the two critical design decisions on that infrastructural level if you really want to scale globally as a stablecoin issuer. Yeah, and this insight then concludes our walkthrough for these four architectural layers. To me, the key learning is actually that the very first choice to be made here as a aspiring stablecoin issuer is choosing the one of these three buckets on the first layer that you described at the outset. So the choice you make there will then really determine how the layers below, the application, the data, the IT infrastructure layer manifest or need to be designed to make this play then materialize.
Yeah, and I also think to that point, those three buckets are key, but also thinking all the way to the end consumer, what is the differentiator? Why would people use your stablecoin over one that's already out there is increasingly going to be the number one question to think through as the market becomes more and more competitive. Because, you know, I don't know about you, but it seems like every week there's another announcement of another major stablecoin coming in, which is exciting. But it also means that the market's going to be increasingly crowded. So designing and coming up with a specific use case that you know your stable is more competitive at is going to be the driving force that then all the other design decisions should come from.
Yeah, and I mean, we've been joking in the podcast using titles like Yet Another Stablecoin in a recent episode with Ibiza, the CTO of Swired, actually predicted that a major consolidation in the market is expected. Most likely you would agree. And therefore, I agree. Yeah. So ever more stablecoin issuers emerge. All of them need to make careful design choices across these architectural layers we discussed today. And if done wrong, there is small likelihood of such an emerging stablecoin issuer to actually survive. So if you choose the wrong bucket, the wrong business model at the outset, not clearly understanding what your unique selling point, your value proposition is, then the stablecoin issuer can design the subsequent levels as perfectly as he wants, but he won't earn money.
Yep.
All right, Thomas. So to me, this has really been a masterclass in thinking about stablecoin issuers as a complete organization rather than just as a technology project, which in my understanding dominates stablecoin conversations at the moment. So we often talk about selected topics like minting and burning or the blockchain used. And with this episode, I really tried to look at stablecoin issuers as complete enterprises. And this architectural lens gives us a much clearer way to understand why certain issuers are succeeding at institutional adoption while others remain niche players. It helps us understand why regulatory compliance is fundamentally about the organizational design of the stablecoin issuer and why technology choices are actually downstream from choices on the business and operating model. So thank you for bringing such technical depth and practical experience to our conversation. For listeners who want to continue following you, Thomas, your work and insights, what's the best way to connect with you?
I would say Twitter and LinkedIn. Thank you again for the time and very excited by this. I think it feels like there are more and more stablecoins every week, but we're still so early that we only have 300 billion and very much looking forward to the growth that we expect and see over the coming years.
Brilliant. So you'll definitely find the links to those two profiles in the show notes. And Thomas, are there any upcoming research pieces or initiatives either from Galaxy or from your end around tokenization or stablecoin infrastructure that our audience should watch out for?
Yeah, I think one thing that's exciting is stablecoins have clearly demonstrated product market fit outside of crypto now. And so now that people are shifting towards tokenized money market funds and tokenizing equities more broadly, we're really going to begin to see stablecoins being used as the case study of what's possible for this technology to then ricochet across the rest of the market. And we're very excited for that to happen. And so from a Galaxy perspective, you know, we're right at the intersection of crypto and TradFi. And so we very much look forward to taking the learnings and example that stablecoins can have and helping push the rest of the market on chain so that in the long run, we end up with the vast majority of the financial system tokenized. It's a long vision, but we think we'll get there.
Excellent. Thomas Cohen from Galaxy Digital. Thank you for joining us on Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock and Roll. For everyone listening, you can find us on YouTube, LinkedIn, and Telegram, where we run community communities in both German and English. By the way, Thomas, we would love you joining these communities, potentially. We'll post detailed show notes for this episode at bitcoinfiatrockandroll.com or bfrr.com, including links to this conversation and Thomas's contact information. If you found this valuable, please subscribe wherever you're listening. In our next episode, we'll be exploring yet another interesting topic on the evolution of digital assets and money. We continue our deep dive into how digital currencies are reshaping financial infrastructure in Europe and beyond. Until then, this is Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock and Roll, bringing Europe's perspective on digital currency to the world. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.